case number 52403. Council ready to proceed?
If I may, Your Honor, my name is Nancy Lemke. I'm here on behalf of Sherry Love. I'm an attorney in the Public Defender's Office, and I would like to, with court's permission, reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Your Honors, in kind of a sad irony, I noticed last night when I was pouring through the transcript again that in closing argument, the prosecutor stood up and said to this jury, and I quote, "Every criminal trial is about the same thing. It's a search for the truth, and the job of the jury is to determine what the facts are and follow the law." A more accurate statement, based on what happened in this trial, would have been that the jury was entitled to this prosecutor's version of the facts, his version of the law, and his version of how a jury should be composed. And that is why we're here today, and that's why Sherry Love did not get the fair trial to which she was constitutionally entitled. It began when the defense noticed three experts to talk about the defendant's mental state at the time of the crime. And as the trial proceeded, let me back up. Before the trial began, the prosecution filed a motion to strike the expert notice that had been filed by the defense. And what they did was, with that, they tried to limit the defense presentation of the psychiatric testimony that would come out in this particular case. And this was critical because the defendant's defense in this particular instance was that she was suffering from extreme mental illness, compounded and exacerbated by ingestion of drugs and alcohol, and that's what led to what happened on this particular day.
What was the specific area of limitation?
Okay. What happened was, as they got into the trial, and the court said, okay, I'm not going to let you do some things, I'm going to hold some rulings in abeyance, and they moved into the trial, we got to the psychiatric testimony of Dr. Paglini, who was the critical defense expert to talk about the defendant's state of mind at the time of the offense. And the state got up before Dr. Paglini testified and said, hey, look, Dr. Paglini is not allowed to get into anything that this defendant told him, even though it forms the basis for his opinion regarding her state of mind at the time of the homicide.
Well, counsel, put very succinctly, wasn't it an issue as to attempting to have the doctor testify for Ms. Love?
No, and Your Honor's point is exactly the point, that, or the argument that the state made. And what they did was, they said, you can't put an expert on to talk about what a defendant said, because that's basically a backdoor way of getting a defendant's statements in. The problem is this: if you preclude an expert from talking, a psychiatric expert, from talking about what a defendant tells that expert relative to what happened at the time of a crime and the mental state that particular defendant was laboring under at the time of a crime, then what you're necessarily doing is preventing that expert from testifying anything regarding the defendant's mental state. And as this court has made clear, an expert is absolutely entitled to offer that kind of opinion testimony.
Well, based upon what you're saying, how do we remedy that? How do we find the fine line, or how do we move the line, since you're saying our line is improperly placed at this time?
Well, an expert should be allowed, there's a statute directly on point, it's 50.2875, and it says, and I quote, if a type reasonably relied on by experts in forming their opinions or inferences upon a subject, the facts or data need not be admissible in evidence. So what that tells us is, by law, an expert is able to get on the stand and talk about information that wouldn't necessarily be otherwise admissible in a court of law, including what a defendant says.
But clearly in this case, we have the hearsay exception. How do we then deal with these two conflicting points of law?
Well, the answer is that the testimony comes in. The expert is allowed to get on the stand and say, and the prosecutor...
Over the hearsay exception.
Well, it's not a hearsay exception. There's two different things there. I don't think there is actually a hearsay exception for this particular testimony. I think it is, this actually falls outside of the hearsay statutes and is actually within the purview of what an expert is allowed to testify. And it says that, you know, an expert is allowed to testify to matters that are not separately admissible. And what happened was the prosecutor cited a case, Walker, saying, hey, look, in Walker, Your Honor specifically said there's no hearsay exception for this type of testimony, which is true. If we were trying to get it in as substantive evidence, as a hearsay exception, that would be absolutely true. But that wasn't what we were trying to do. We were saying, look, in order for our expert to present his opinion to the extent that we are allowed to do by law and to the extent that we need to ensure that she gets the fair trial that she's entitled to, he has to testify to this. And this is why the statute allows it. And truthfully, Your Honor, the remedy is, or the resolution of this issue is such that the statements come in. A doctor can get on the stand and say, look,
Isn't the resolution of this found in the expert witness instruction itself? Which says you can consider the opinions of the expert, but the basis may not be admissible or may not be considered as evidence.
Sure, and more importantly, I think to that point, the prosecutor can get up and argue a garbage in, garbage out. They can get up and say through their cross-examination and through their argument, hey, look, keep in mind that this expert's testimony is based largely on what the defendant told this expert.
But the interesting aspect of this area is how far can the expert go? Can the expert, for example, recite some fact or some report that may not form a basis for the opinion under the guise of inadmissible hearsay?
Right, sure. I mean, if a particular fact or report was not part of the basis for the expert's opinion, then certainly I don't see how it would be even relevant thereto. So I don't know how that
so
would actually...
So if the testimony proceeds and that gets out, it can be objected to and stricken.
Right, certainly. But if there was evidence, you know, be it a review of a report...
So what were your client's statements? How did your client's statements further the opinions here?
Well, we never got that testimony in, so unfortunately the record's a little scant in that area, and I concede that.
That was my question. Where's the proffer here?
Right, and I think Your Honor makes a good point. You know, there, what happened was, you know, they were in the middle of trial. The motion was rebrought to the court's attention to exclude the statements the defendant makes, and then shortly after that, defense counsel says, well, Judge, if we can't get into what the defendant has said to this expert, we're not going to be able to present what we would have done with this expert, which was the stuff going to the defendant's state of mind and all that. And that necessarily...
But that's the weakness, or at least appears to be...
You're correct.
...in deciding this appeal. I mean, what do we look to? What's the proffer that we say, okay, well, if this opinion had been offered, the result would have been different.
Right, and I understand what Your Honor is saying. What I would refer you to is, number one, the concession by defense counsel that they would have put in the state of mind testimony, but for the ruling kind of eviscerating the expert testimony by saying you can't get into the defendant's statements. And secondly, referring you to the notice of expert that was filed in this case, in which they specifically stated that the expert was going to testify to the defendant's state of mind at the time of the crime. Now, she had entered a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, so we know one thing for certain, that the testimony regarding the state of mind would have encompassed facts or factors that amount to insanity, and that secondly, that as they argued in closing argument...
Let's assume for the moment that the defense had done a proper proffer on we had something to really look to. There's an interesting difference of opinion about the role of the drug use and voluntary intoxication in support of an insanity defense. Why should the court, which rule should the court consider? And Judge Bell seemed to go with what he perceived to be a majority opinion.
On the jury instruction?
Yes.
Tell me again which instruction you're talking about. The voluntary intoxication as it relates to insanity?
23, I believe. 23, I believe.
Okay.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. 27.
27, okay. Yeah, with that particular instruction, and this gets back to my point that the state pretty much got everything that they wanted with respect to creating a law that, creating jury instructions that essentially foreclosed any kind of defense verdict, and this was one of them, where the court said that it would, that you couldn't consider the intoxication, the voluntary intoxication, with respect to the insanity. And certainly, it defies logic, truthfully, to say that somebody who's insane, who might have also intoxicated themselves, be it voluntarily or involuntarily, is still, does still not necessarily legally meet the criteria of insanity just by virtue of their intoxication. In other words, you can be insane and also be intoxicated, or be insane and not be intoxicated, but under either scenario, you have that base level insanity that is deserving of an insanity verdict. And when the judge gave an instruction that said, hey, look, you jurors cannot find insanity if you indeed find that there's some admixture, if you will, of intoxication, it's over. Well, we all know the undisputed facts were that Sherry was intoxicated. I mean, you know, through her own doing or otherwise, you know, she had a multitude of intoxicants in her system, not the least of which was alcohol, to the extent that it was twice the legal limit. And we had two experts, one of whom was the state, concede that in somebody with bipolar disorder, these can have that these drugs can have a very idiosyncratic, and I'm quoting with that term, result in that it can they can cause agitation, violent behavior. They can even result in psychosis, where you get to the point of having hallucinations and delusions. So the tragic reality of the situation was that because there was such overwhelming evidence of intoxication, that now you have, and if I may briefly conclude, and then I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Now when you have an instruction that tells jurors, look, if you have any mixture of that intoxication, even if you have some component of insanity, you're done.
But the point of it is, under U.S. versus Knott, the Ninth Circuit case, that instruction seems to be supported by that holding. And the thrust of my question was, why should we consider some other alternative, and what would be the support for it?
Well, number one, I just think common sense, as you know, as I just articulated, that you have the situation where an insane person shouldn't be precluded from an insanity verdict by virtue of their additional intoxication. But secondly, there are, I don't know what year Knott was decided, Your Honor, and I'd
have to,
was it 90? Yeah, there were some cases, I hadn't seen that one, there were some Ninth Circuit cases that were issued before that talked about the fact that you shouldn't foreclose upon an insanity verdict simply by virtue of intoxication also. But I did not see Knott, and I would be happy to review that and address it in supplemental briefing if the court would allow.
Counsel, very quickly also, as to this instruction, if I'm correct, there was no objection to giving an instruction by defense?
You are correct, Your Honor. So we would ask that you review it under plain error standards.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lankey. Ms. Wolfen?
Good morning. My name is Pam Wesserly, and I represent the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I was also one of the trial lawyers in the case of the State of Nevada versus Sherry Love. I'm sure the court is familiar with the facts of this case. I mean, it is a tragic circumstance. The defendant in this case checked herself into a hospital for alcohol detoxification at the end of January of 1997. She got her last dose of prescribed medication on the 1st of February at about 4 in the morning, and she left an hour after. Her son, her 15-year-old son, Michael, observed her on the 2nd of February, which is the day before the homicide, and observed nothing unusual about her behavior. She said she was going to go get her hair done. She said she was going to go get a manicure. After she leaves her son, she obviously voluntarily intoxicates herself. She goes to a bar. She drinks. And her son sees her around dinner time that evening when she's brought bar food home to feed her children, and it seems to him like she's been drinking, but he certainly notes no evidence of delusion. She has a conversation with a roommate, a pretty sophisticated conversation about, let me borrow some money because I want to go gamble, I'll take it off the rent that you owe me. So no evidence of delusion at all on the second, which is the day before the homicide took place. We move into the evening, she leaves, she goes to the bar again, and her son Michael doesn't see her till the early morning of the 3rd. At that point, he gets a phone call from her. She's upset with him about the fact that he hasn't cleaned the residence. And he eventually sees his mom on the 3rd, which is the morning of the homicide, and he doesn't notice any delusional behavior, no evidence of psychosis. Ms. Love interacts with a neighbor who she's known for a substantial amount of time. Once again, the neighbor notes no evidence of delusion. She does appear to have been drinking, definitely that, but no evidence that she's in any kind of psychotic state. Ms. Love then interacts with police officers on 2 different occasions on the 3rd. They, again, observe that she does seem to have alcohol present, but she's not stumbling drunk, and they see no evidence of psychotic behavior, no evidence of delusion. Then our murder occurs where she stabbed her 7-year-old daughter 20 times, and then she tells her son, who witnessed it, this won't hurt, and from his testimony, she climbed up on the bunk bed where he was, saying this won't hurt, and she stabbed him. He was able to get away from his mother. The fact that she's saying this won't hurt to her son certainly suggests she was oriented as to what she was doing. Was this a healthy person? No. But does that qualify as insanity under the law of the state of Nevada? Certainly not.
Well, counsel, that gets us to the point of, I guess, picking up the argument raised by defense, that they were not given the opportunity to adequately put their defense into play.
And Your Honor, I'd like to address that specifically. The defense noticed 3 experts in this state, in this case. One was Dr. Paglini, and the expert notice did say he was going to testify as to the state of mind of the defendant at the time of the crime. We received no report from Dr. Paglini, and he was the only defense expert who actually interviewed the defendant. They also noticed Dr. Pohl, who is an expert on various medications combined with alcohol, that sort of thing. So we went into trial with someone entering a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity with absolutely no report and no description from the notice as to what exactly her mental defect was that the defense was alleging and what her delusion was at the time of the crime.
But those failures weren't the basis of the court's exclusion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The court excluded that evidence because it concluded that this would be improper hearsay for the expert to rely upon.
Right, and they did.
Which begs the question, when and under what circumstances can a psychiatrist testify without repeating or stating what the defendant or the subject of the testimony has said to him or her?
I think that's a good point, and I read that statute 5285 differently. The defense did say at the time that under that statute it says that the expert can rely on anything and essentially regurgitate it at trial. The state's position was, no, the statute never says that the evidence is admissible. It says the expert can rely on evidence that may not be admissible in forming their opinion. But I don't believe, and the defense did make that same argument that you just suggested, Justice Hardesty, that I don't believe that you could never put on an insanity defense without having a defendant testify. Everyone's certainly limited to the facts of this case, but if there are occasions where a crime could be committed in front of a crowd or in front of other individuals, and witnesses could see and hear someone talking about aliens or talking about things that aren't there, that type of testimony wouldn't be admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. You could put on percipient witnesses to a killing who could explain, I saw this person talking in a delusional state, they were talking about things that weren't there, I observed all of that. And an expert could rely on that and certainly formulate an opinion that at the time of the killing, the defendant was in a delusional state or couldn't appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions. The record in this case, though, is quite different. I disagree with defense counsel that there isn't any record at all as to what Dr. Paglini was going to testify to. First of all, at 752 in the record and at 753, the court's ruling with regard to Dr. Paglini's testimony was that he could talk about, based on my interview of the defendant, I formed this diagnosis. Based on my conversation with the defendant, this is my conclusion about her mental state at the time of the crime. And when he was on direct examination...
Without repeating what the defendant told him.
Exactly.
So he could offer his opinion,
absolutely,
but he was limited in the basis that he could provide the jury with.
Correct. And if you read through the testimony of Dr. Paglini, the defense never asked him, what is your opinion of her mental state at the time of the crime? Do you have an opinion if she was in a delusional state or not? That was absolutely not asked of Dr. Paglini through the entire direct testimony. On cross, we went through all the contacts that she had with various individuals, none of whom were observing any kind of delusional conduct. And the doctor acknowledged, well, yes, there isn't really evidence that she was in a delusional state, but, you know, perhaps she might have been. What he would have testified to, had he been allowed to go into the facts, as you were alluding to, what the defendant essentially told him, I think there's certainly not a vast record, but at 752 and at 758, the defense alluded to what his testimony would have been, and essentially it would have been amnesia, that this crime was committed, and I don't have any recollection as to what happened. And we did, the state of Nevada did talk to Dr. Paglini, and that's consistent, I mean, pretrial, not on the stand, and that is consistent with our interview with him. But at those
Well, your interview isn't in the record.
That's correct. That's correct.
All right,
but at 752 and at 758, the defense said that essentially her version of events to him was, I don't remember what happened at the time of the murder. And they equate that with insanity, and they say, well, therefore, she was incapable of understanding the nature of her conduct. And my understanding or my belief in the state of the law of insanity in Nevada is that's just not enough. You can't say that you don't remember. There's no delusion at the time of the crime that's established with that kind of amnesia defense. And it certainly doesn't indicate that at the time of the crime she didn't appreciate the wrongfulness of her actions. There's no evidence that she thought her daughter was going to hurt her. She thought her daughter was an inanimate object. There's nothing like that in an amnesia type defense. And given that that was the testimony, or that was the basis of his opinion, they arguably weren't entitled to any kind of insanity instructions. But moving on specifically to sort of the issue on 5285 and what that statute allows, I heard Justice Hardesty talk about, well, gee, what's the extent of that? And certainly as a prosecutor, that's a huge concern. If this court decides to interpret it according to the defense, when I read that statute, I don't see any limitation. I mean, what are how many levels of hearsay are acceptable under 285? Do they even have to talk to the defendant, or can they talk to a mother or a brother? You know, the defendant told me that at the time of the crime. I mean, there's no limitation to it. And how do we separate out on cross-examination in a meaningful way? What is the basis of the opinion if they get a collection of reports? You know, the state's position is that it's absolutely hearsay and that the strict reading of 285 doesn't say that the statute overcomes the hearsay violation. It merely talks about what an expert can rely upon in forming an opinion. Now, Ms. Lemke and the trial lawyers at the time, they said, well, it's not hearsay. We're not really offering it for the truth of the matter asserted. We're just offering it for the basis of the opinion, the basis of the doctor's conclusion. And candidly, that I don't think that's a really accurate statement, because what a doctor essentially will be saying is, she told me her daughter was trying to kill her at the time or whatever, and that's why she acted in the way she did. And I conclude, therefore, that she was insane at the time. If that type of testimony is offered through an expert, the expert's necessarily vouching for the credibility of the defendant, and that type of testimony...
Counsel, in civil cases, every day, a doctor relates the symptoms, the effects of an injury by the plaintiff, if it's a plaintiff's expert or even a defense expert. Under your theory, none of that could be offered in those trials, and that's simply not the case.
I wouldn't say none of it could be offered. I would say that the factual underpinnings can't be offered. And I think the court...
In every workman's compensation case, in every civil case, the modality of injury is communicated by the injured plaintiff to the doctor to assist in reaching an opinion that this spine injury was caused by this car accident.
I can see that type of testimony or an opinion about the psychotic state. What I can't see and what I think is precluded by the statute and also some case law is at the time of the offense, I was scared, or at the time of the offense, I believed my daughter was an object.
But you're quibbling over what the contents is that actually supports the opinion. If Ms. Love in this case had said to Paglini a bunch of stuff that doesn't support an opinion that she's insane, then the opinion isn't supported, very much like how you characterize what the ultimate opinion was to be here, amnesia.
Right. Well, I think
sort of begs the question, how did Paglini get on the stand in the first place? But
I agree with you.
But that we're talking about the basis for the opinion, and as long as the information that's being communicated would be used by the expert in forming the opinion, the absence of that information seems to me to violate the rule.
Well, I agree that the rule does allow for some communication of the opinion. I don't think that there's a meaningful cross-examination opportunity of the state to test that hypothesis if the expert's the only one who testifies.
Could you comment on how statements for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment, the hearsay exception, might distinguish this case from the conventional workers' comp type setting?
Well, you're asking me to go a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but in the Walker case, that was the exception, but it was the same type of testimony. But the defense said, well, this comes under the medical records exception. And the court said, no, this is clearly hearsay. It's not admissible because it was obtained for the purposes of litigation or for the purposes of the criminal trial. And I don't think the Walker case or 50285 makes it not hearsay. I'd also add that in the Townsend case, the state called an expert in a sexual assault case, and the expert relayed some of the victim's testimony, which included identification of the perpetrator. And in the Townsend case, this court said that was improper expert testimony because it was invading the fact-finding province of the jury. In the Pineda case, a defendant was involved in a gang shooting, and a gang expert was excluded. This court said that it was improper for him to testify to the facts of the case, how the defendant felt, but it was improper to exclude his testimony with regard to the nature of gang interactions or how those actions are kind of heightened standard of or a heightened level of intensity, because he could have corroborated what the defendant said. And I think that's the distinction.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ruckley. Your final argument, Ms. Lemke?
Your Honor, you make a good point when you point out the civil cases. Look, what this comes down to is this. They don't want the defendant's statements coming in through an expert. That's not what they want to do. And it's all this talk about, well, you can distinguish between this type of information that an expert relies on and some other type of information that they rely on is nonsense. If you want to get into some crazy case law, then opinions regarding, well, this is admissible from an expert, but this isn't admissible, you could spend a lifetime coming up with things that are and are not. The bottom line is this. The statute that authorizes them to discuss this material, it's not a statute that 50.285. It's not telling them what you can do as an expert. Here's what you can do. Go rely on these things. It's saying once you rely on them, you can come to court and talk about them. And you can talk about them without distinguishing whether or not it's something that came from a defendant or something that came from someone else. And I would point out in that regard the selectivity with which the state would like you to kind of pick and choose in terms of things they can and can't rely on is best illustrated by the fact that they had zero problem cross-examining our expert, Dr. Paglini, on rank hearsay in the form of an alleged threat that our client had made to an ex-boyfriend months before the incident that brought us all here today ever occurred. And that gets back to my, to the remedy, really, is that it's a garbage in, garbage out thing. The expert can get on the stand and testify pursuant to statute about anything that they use to form the basis of their opinion. And it doesn't matter what that source is, if it's a treatise, if it's a report, any of that information is fair game, okay? If it's the words that come from the defendant, the remedy is that on cross-examination, well, this is what the defendant told you, yes. And this defendant's facing life in prison, yes. So this defendant might have a self-serving motivation to tell you things that might be favorable, to make your testimony as favorable as possible, yes. There's your remedy right there. But picking and choosing what an expert can walk into court and testify to is nonsense. What this was their very not-so-thinly-veiled attempt to gut the defense testimony. And with respect to that testimony...
Counsel asked that testimony, if I heard correctly. The question was asked of Ms. Weckley whether or not you proffered what the testimony was going to be. And right. She said, no, it was not proffered, but even a written declaration of what that testimony was going to be.
Right. Your Honor, in a perfect world, I would be standing...
Well, this is not even a perfect world.
I know.
Just the question, did they do that?
I know it. I know. And I'm limited to the record. And I don't want to go outside the scope of the record and talk about things that information that I necessarily learned from trial counsel. What I can tell you is that what's in the record and the facts lend credibility to this. And this goes back to what she said when she gave you this recitation.
The credibility would have been, did we have an expert report offered?
No, there was not an expert report that was put in the record. No. All we know is that Paglini, the defense made clear before he testified that if you preclude us from admitting evidence of what the defendant said, you're going to eviscerate our ability to talk about what happened what was going through her mind at the time of the crime. And that's critical because this wasn't an incident where, as counsel described, that she just cogently went and picked up a knife and killed her child. She had had a history of mental illness. She was in and out of hospitals to treat that mental illness. Her most recent visit to a hospital was 2 days before this crime occurred. They gave her medicine that had some unintended consequences with somebody like her who had the history and severe history of bipolar disorder, and it spiraled down from there. She was absolutely nuts at the time that this offense occurred. This wasn't a calm, cool, collected, well-rationed decision. And the jury had the right to hear that evidence. They had the right to hear how her psychiatric expert interpreted that evidence. And because they never heard that, and because the instructions were crafted in a way such that they really couldn't consider anything once the issue of intoxication came up, the result was a foregone conclusion. And all I'm asking for is, Your Honor, to reverse this case and give Sherry Love the ability to present her full and fair defense at trial. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefs this morning. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until 11:30. Thank you.
All rise.